This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents An Unwanted Guest by Sherry LaPena. Read for you by Hilary Huber. Chapter 1. Friday, 4:45 p.m. The road curves and twists unexpectedly as it leads higher and deeper into the Catskill Mountains, as if the farther you get from civilization, the more uncertain the path. The shadows are deepening, the weather worsening. The Hudson River is there, appearing and disappearing from view. The forest that rises on either side of the road has a lurking quality, as if it might swallow you whole. It is the forest of fairy tales. The softly falling snow, however, lends it all a certain postcard charm. Gwen Delaney grips the steering wheel tightly and squints through the windshield. She's more one for grim fairy tales than picture postcards. The light is going. It will soon be dark. The snow coming down makes driving more difficult, more tiring. The flakes hit the glass in such profusion that she feels as though she's stuck in some kind of relentless video game. And the road is definitely becoming more slippery. She's grateful that she has good tires on her little Fiat. Everything is turning into a white blur. It's hard to tell where the road ends and the ditch begins. She'll be glad when they get there. She's beginning to wish they'd chosen an inn a little less remote. This one is miles from anywhere. Riley Shooter is silent in the passenger seat beside her, a ball of quiet tension. It's impossible not to pick up on it. Just being with her in the small car puts Gwen on edge. She hopes she hasn't made a mistake bringing her up here. The whole point of this little escape, Gwen thinks, is to get Riley to relax a little, to take her mind off things. Gwen bites her lip and stares hard at the road ahead. She's a city girl, born and bred. She's not used to country driving. It gets so dark up here. She's becoming anxious now. The drive has taken longer than planned. They shouldn't have stopped for coffee at that cute little antique place along the way. She's not sure what she expected, suggesting this weekend getaway other than a change of scenery, a chance to spend some quiet time together, with nothing to remind Riley that her life is in ruins. Perhaps that was naive. Gwen has her own baggage, less recent, and she too carries it with her everywhere she goes. But she's decided she's going to put that behind her for this weekend at least. A small luxury hotel deep in the country, good food, no internet, pristine nature. It's exactly what they both need. Riley watches nervously out of the car window, peering into the shadowy woods, trying not to imagine someone jumping in front of their car at any second, waving them down. She clenches her hands into fists inside the pockets of her down jacket. She reminds herself that she's not in Afghanistan anymore. She's home, safe, in New York State. Nothing bad can happen to her here. Her career has changed her. Seeing what she has seen, Riley is so different that she hardly recognizes herself anymore. She glances furtively at Gwen. They'd been close once. She's not even sure why she agreed to come with her to this faraway country inn. She watches Gwen concentrating fiercely on the winding road up the slippery incline, heading into the mountains. "Are you okay?" she asks suddenly. "Me?" Gwen says. "Yeah, I'm fine. We should be there soon." In journalism school, when they were both at NYU, Gwen had been the steady, pragmatic one. But Riley was ambitious. She wanted to be where it was happening. Gwen had no taste for adventure. She'd always preferred books and quiet. Out of journalism school, unable to find a decent job at a newspaper, Gwen had quickly parlayed her skills into a good corporate communications position and had never seemed to regret it. But Riley had headed to the war zones, and she'd managed to keep it together for a long time. Why does she do this? Why does she keep thinking about it? She can feel herself starting to come apart. She tries to slow her breathing, the way she's been taught, to stop the images from coming back, from taking over. David Paley parks his car in the shoveled parking area to the right of the hotel. He gets out of the car and stretches. The weather made the drive from New York City longer than expected, and now his muscles are stiff, a reminder that he's not quite as young as he used to be. Before grabbing his overnight bag from the back seat of his Mercedes, he stands for a moment in the thickly falling snow, looking at Mitchell's Inn. It's a three-story, graceful-looking structure of red brick and gingerbread trim, encircled by nearby forest. The front of the small hotel is open to view, with what must be a rather grand lawn underneath all the snow. Tall evergreens and mature trees, bereft of leaves but draped in white, seem to encroach on the building from a short distance away. In the front, an enormous tree in the middle of the lawn extends its thick branches in every direction. All is covered in a pure, muffling white snow. It feels quiet here, peaceful, and he feels his shoulders begin to relax. There are large rectangular windows spaced regularly across all three floors. Wide steps lead up to a wooden porch and double front doors decorated with boughs of evergreens. Although it is still daylight, barely, the lamps on either side of the doors are lit, and soft yellow light also spills from the windows on the ground floor, giving the building a warm, welcoming appearance. David stands still, willing the stresses of the day, and the week, and the years, to recede as the snow falls gently on his hair and tickles his lips. He feels like he's walking into an earlier, more gracious, more innocent time. He will try not to think about work for an entire 48 hours. Everyone, no matter how busy, needs to recharge once in a while, even, perhaps especially, a top criminal attorney. It's rare for him to be able to fit in any downtime at all, much less an entire weekend. He's determined to enjoy it. Friday, 5 p.m. Lauren Day glances at the man next to her, Ian Beaton. He's driving his car expertly in rather challenging conditions and making it all look easy. He has a disarming smile, and he turns it on her now. She smiles back. He's nice looking, too, tall and spare. But it's the smile that first attracted her to him, his laid-back charm that makes him so appealing. Lauren rummages through her handbag for her lipstick. She finds it, a nice shade of red that brightens her face, and applies it carefully while looking in the mirror on the visor in front of her. The car skids a bit, and she stops what she's doing, but Ian straightens the vehicle skillfully. The road winds more steeply now, and the car has an increasing tendency to swerve as it loses traction. "Getting slippery," she says. "No worries. Nothing I can't handle," he says and grins at her. She smiles back. She likes his self-confidence, too. "Whoa, what's that?" she says suddenly. There's a dark shape in front of them to the right. It's a dull day, and with the snow falling so heavily, it's hard to see. But it looks like there's a car in the ditch. She stares keenly out the window as they pass by the vehicle, and Ian looks for somewhere to stop. "I think there's someone in that car," she says. "Why don't they have the hazard lights on?" he mutters. He pulls over slowly to the side of the road, careful not to slide off the road himself. Lauren gets out of the warmth of the car and plunges into several inches of virgin snow, which immediately falls inside her boots, stinging her ankles. She can hear Ian getting out of the car, too, slamming the door. "Hey!" she cries down to the motionless car. The driver's door opens slowly. Lauren clambers down the incline carefully, sliding as she goes. The ground is uneven, and she finds it hard to keep her balance. She reaches the car and grabs onto the door with her left hand for support as she peers into the front seat. "You okay?" she asks. The driver is a woman close to her own age, around 30. She appears a bit shaken up, but the windshield isn't cracked and she's wearing a seatbelt. Lauren looks beyond the driver to the woman in the passenger seat. Her face is pale and sweating, and she's staring straight ahead, as if Lauren isn't even there. She looks like she's had a dreadful shock. The driver glances quickly at her companion and then turns back to Lauren gratefully. Yes, we're fine. We went off the road just a few minutes ago. We were wondering what to do next. Lucky for us, you came along. Lauren feels Ian come up behind her and peer over her shoulder at the two women inside the car. He smiles his charming smile at them. Looks like you're going to need a tow. Great, the driver says. Where are you headed? Lauren asks. Mitchell's Inn, she answers.
Well, isn't that lucky? Ian says. That's where we're going too. Although I don't think there's much else out here. Why don't we give you a lift? And you can arrange from the hotel for someone to come get your car out.
The woman smiles with relief and nods. She's obviously glad to be rescued. Lauren doesn't blame her. You could freeze to death out here all by yourself. But the woman with her doesn't react. She seems to be in her own world. You have any bags? Lauren asks. Yes, in the back. The driver gets out of the car and struggles through the deep snow to the back of the vehicle. Her passenger now seems to snap out of her trance and gets out on the other side. The driver opens the hatch as the woman appears beside her. They each grab an overnight bag. Ian reaches down and offers all three women a hand up to the road. Even with help, it's an awkward climb. Thanks so much, the driver says. My name is Gwen, and this is Riley. I'm Lauren, and this is Ian, she says. Let's get in the car. It's so cold. She casts a furtive glance at the woman named Riley, who hasn't said a word. She wonders what's up with her. Something about her definitely seems off. Chapter 2. Friday, 5 p.m. Beverly Sullivan drops her overnight bag at her feet and lets her eyes sweep around the room. It's perfect, just like the one in the brochure. There's an old-fashioned luxury here that she's not accustomed to, and she moves about the room, touching things. The antique king-size bed is heaped with pillows. The carved wardrobe is gorgeous, and the thick oriental carpet must have cost a fortune. She steps up to the windows, which face out over the front of the hotel. The snowfall has made everything indescribably beautiful. New fallen snow always makes her feel hopeful. She turns away from the windows and peeks into the ensuite bath, a spotless oasis of white marble and fluffy white towels. She checks her appearance briefly in the elaborate mirror over the vanity and turns away. Sitting down on the bed, testing it, she begins to wonder what's taking her husband so long. Henry had stayed down at the front desk to inquire about cross-country skis and God knows what else, and she'd come up to the room herself. He insisted that she not wait for him, although she'd been perfectly willing to sit in one of the deep blue velvet chairs or sofas around the stone fireplace in the lobby while he fussed over the equipment. But she didn't want to make an issue of it. She tries not to feel disappointed. It will take time for him to begin to relax. But he seems to be looking for ways to fill their weekend with activities when all she wants to do is slow down and simply be together. It's almost as if he's avoiding being with her, as if he doesn't want to be here at all. She knows her marriage is in disrepair. She wouldn't say it's in trouble, exactly, but it needs work. They have drifted apart, begun to take each other for granted. She's guilty of it, too. How does a modern marriage survive all the forces that converge to tear it apart? Too much familiarity. The dreariness of domesticity, of paying bills, raising children, of having full-time jobs and always too much to do. She doesn't know if a weekend away at a lovely and remote place in the country will make that much of a difference, but it could be a start. A start they certainly wouldn't get if they stayed at home. They desperately need a chance to reconnect, to remember what they like about each other, away from squabbling, sullen teenagers who demand their attention and drain their energies. She sighs and slumps inwardly. She wishes they didn't argue so much about the kids. She's hoping that here they'll be able to talk about things without being interrupted, without that constant, wearying, underlying tension. She wonders with a vague unease how the weekend will unfold and if anything will be different by the time they return home. Henry Sullivan lingers near the reception desk in the lobby to the left of the grand staircase. The smell of logs burning in the fireplace reminds him of Christmases as a boy. He looks at some glossy flyers advertising local restaurants and attractions. Although local may be stretching it a bit, they're pretty far away from things up here. Unfortunately, with all the snow, it looks like it might be too difficult to go anywhere anyway. But the young man at the desk said the snowplows would be running tomorrow and the roads should be fine. Henry fingers the cell phone in his pants pocket. There's no reception up here, which is something he hadn't been expecting. Beverly hadn't mentioned that. He feels a twinge of annoyance. He's not sure why he agreed to this weekend away, except perhaps out of guilt. He already regrets it. He just wants to go home. He fantasizes harmlessly for a moment about getting back in his car and leaving his wife here. How long would it be before she noticed he was gone? What would she do? Quickly, he squashes the fantasy. His wife has been looking increasingly unhappy lately, but, he tells himself, it's not just because of him. It's the kids, too, her job, encroaching middle age, her thickening waistline. It's everything. But one person can't be responsible for another person's happiness. She is responsible for her own. He can't make her happy. Yet, he's not a complete heel. He knows it's not that simple. He loved her once. She's the mother of his children. He simply doesn't love her anymore. And he has no idea what to do about it. Dana Hart stamps the snow off her Stuart Weitzman boots at the front doorstep and looks around the lobby approvingly. The first thing that strikes her is the grand central staircase. The newel post and railings are elaborately carved out of a burnished, dark wood. The stairs are wide, with a thick runner in a dark floral pattern. She can see the glint of the brass carpet rods holding the runner in place. It's very impressive, and these days, Dana isn't easily impressed. The staircase makes her think of Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind, or perhaps Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard. It's the kind of staircase you put on your best long dress for and make an entrance, she thinks. I'm ready for my close-up. Unfortunately, she didn't bring any evening gowns. What a shame for such a glorious staircase to go to waste, she thinks. Next, she notices the large stone fireplace on the left side of the lobby. Around it are arranged a lot of comfortable-looking sofas and chairs for lounging in, some in deep blue velvet, others in dark brown leather, accompanied by little tables with lamps on them. The walls are paneled halfway up from the floor with dark wooden wainscoting. A gorgeous Persian carpet covers part of the dark wood floors and makes everything feel cozy but expensive, which is just what she likes. A chandelier sparkles overhead. The smell of the wood fire reminds her of blissful days spent at Matthew's family cottage. She breathes deeply and smiles. She's a very happy woman. Recently engaged on a weekend tryst with the man she is going to marry. Everything is glorious, including this lovely hotel that Matthew has found for them. He dropped her in front and is parking the car. They'll be here in a minute with their bags. She sets off across the lobby, past the fireplace, to the old-fashioned reception desk to the left of the staircase. Everything here gleams with a patina of age and good furniture polish. There is a young man behind the desk, and another man, older, obviously a guest, leaning against it, leafing through some pamphlets. He glances up when he sees her. He stops for a second, stares, and then smiles in an embarrassed way and looks away. She's used to it. She has that effect on men, as if when they see her, they can't believe their eyes for a minute. She can't help that. The younger man behind the desk does an almost imperceptible double take, but it's there. She's used to that, too. I'm Dana Hart. My fiancé and I have a reservation under the name Matthew Hutchinson.
Yes, of course, the young man says smoothly and looks at the register. She notices that they use an old hotel register, how quaint, rather than a computer system for checking in guests. Behind the desk, against the wall, are wooden pigeonholes for the room keys. You're in room 201, up the stairs to the second floor and to the right, the young man tells her. The door opens behind her with a burst of cold air, and she turns to see Matthew with a bag in each hand and a dusting of snow on his coat and on his dark hair. He comes up beside her, and she brushes the snow off his shoulders. She enjoys these little demonstrations of ownership. Welcome to Mitchell's Inn, the young man behind the desk says, smiling and handing over a heavy brass key. She notices how attractive he is. Dinner is in the dining room from 7 to 9 p.m. We offer drinks in the lobby before dinner. Enjoy your stay. Thank you. I'm sure we will, her fiancé says, giving her a look. She raises her perfectly shaped eyebrows at him, her way of telling him to behave himself in public. Matthew picks up the bags again and follows Dana up the wide staircase. He notices that there's no elevator. It's a small hotel. He chose carefully. He wanted someplace quiet and intimate to spend some time with Dana before all the craziness of the wedding, which he would prefer to avoid altogether. He wishes they could elope to some delightful spot in the Caribbean. But the heir to a large fortune in New England does not elope. Such a thing would crush his mother and all his aunts, and he's not prepared to do that. And he knows that Dana, despite her sometimes becoming overwhelmed with the stress of the planning, the appointments, the millions of details such a wedding entails, is actually quite thrilled about the whole thing. But she's been prone to emotional outbursts lately. This break will be good for both of them before the final push to their spring wedding. The thick rug softens their footsteps so that it is almost perfectly quiet as they walk up the stairs to the second floor and a few steps along the hall to room 201. There is an oval brass plate on the door engraved with the number and an old-fashioned keyhole lock. He unlocks the door and opens it for her. After you. She steps inside and smiles approvingly. It's lovely, she says. She whirls to face him as he closes the door firmly behind them. He puts his arms around her and says, You are lovely. He kisses her. Eventually, she pushes him away with a playful shove. She shrugs out of her coat. He does the same and hangs them up in the wardrobe. They examine the room together. The bed is king size, of course, and the linens, he notes, are first rate. There are chocolates wrapped in foil resting on the pillows. The bathtub is obviously intended for two, and a bucket of champagne on ice rests on a little table near the door with a note of welcome. The windows look out onto the vast front lawn with snow-weighted trees and the long curving drive leading down to the main road, filling up fast now with snow. Half a dozen cars are parked in the lot to the side of the lawn. The two lovers stand together side by side, looking out. It's the honeymoon suite, he tells her, if you haven't already guessed. Isn't that bad luck, she asks, to book the honeymoon suite
When it's not really your honeymoon?
No, I don't think so.
They watch a car struggle bravely up the drive and pull slowly into the lot. Four people get out, three women and a man. He nuzzles her neck and says, "How about a nap before dinner?"
Ian Beaton drops into one of the chairs next to the fireplace in the lobby while Lauren signs in and gets the key to their room. He wouldn't mind a drink. He wonders where the bar is. The dining room is to the right, off the lobby. The glass doors to the dining room are open, and he can see tables with white linen tablecloths set up inside. The place is quite charming. Probably lots of little rooms and hallways and alcoves by the look of it. Not like a typical modern hotel, built for efficiency and maximum returns. He turns his attention to the two women they rescued. Gwen, the driver, is getting the key to their room. It looks like they're sharing. He watches them go up the stairs together. He lets his mind drift. Lauren approaches and holds out her hand to him.
Ready to go up?
Sure.
Dinner is from 7 to 9 in the dining room, but we can have cocktails down here, she tells him.
Good. What are we waiting for?
We're on the third floor. He gets up and lifts the bags, then follows Lauren up the stairs. The place seems so quiet. Maybe it's the snow, or the thick carpet, or the soft lighting, but everything seems muffled, subdued.
Did you notice anything odd about that woman, Riley? Lauren whispers as they climb the elaborate staircase.
She looked pretty rattled,
he admits. She didn't say a word the whole time. I mean, they only slid into a ditch. No actual harm done.
Maybe she's been in a car accident before.
Maybe. When they reach the third floor, she turns to him and says, "She seemed awfully tense. I got a weird vibe off her."
"Don't think about her," Ian says, giving her a sudden kiss. "Think about me."
Chapter 3. Friday, 5:30 p.m. Gwen sits on the bed farthest from the door. They have a room on the third floor with two double beds as requested, and watches Riley anxiously. She could tell that woman, Lauren, had been wondering about her. It dawns on Gwen for the first time that maybe she isn't what Riley needs right now. Gwen is becoming infected by Riley's quiet panic rather than Riley being reassured by Gwen's calm pragmatism. Riley has always been the stronger personality. She probably should have realized that Riley would have an effect on her rather than the other way around. Already, Gwen finds herself looking into dark corners, jumping at unexpected sounds, imagining bad things happening. Perhaps it's just being in a strange place, in the old-world atmosphere of this hotel.
"Maybe we should freshen up a bit and go down for a drink before dinner?" Gwen suggests.
"Sure," Riley says unenthusiastically. She's pale, and her long, blonde hair hangs limply around her face. There is none of that liveliness she used to have. She was beautiful once, but now it's hard to think of her that way.
What an awful thought, Gwen realizes. She hopes that beauty will return.
Gwen looks imploringly at her. "I know you're going through a tough time, but you have to try."
Riley flashes a look at her. Annoyance, maybe. Or resentment.
Anger.
Gwen feels a little flare of anger of her own and thinks suddenly that it's going to be a long weekend if she has to watch everything she says. But she immediately reminds herself that Riley is one of her best friends. She owes her. She wants to help her get back on her feet. She wants her gorgeous, vivacious friend back. She wants to be jealous of her again, she realizes, like she used to be.
"Let me brush your hair," Gwen says.
She gets up off her bed and rummages through Riley's handbag for her hairbrush. Then she sits down on the bed behind her and starts brushing her hair in long, soothing strokes. As she does, she sees Riley's shoulders begin to loosen a little. Finally, she says, "There, put some lipstick on.
I will too, and we'll go down and get something to eat. Then we can come up here and have a quiet night and talk, just like we used to, or read if that's what you want. She's brought a couple of books herself. She wouldn't mind escaping into a book. Her own life is far from perfect. A corridor runs past the reception desk along the west side of the hotel, dividing the west wing of the hotel into front and back rooms. Down the hall is a bar, but when David Paley pops his head in, the room is empty. To the right of the door is the bar itself, with an impressive array of liquor bottles, but there is no one behind it to serve him. The room is paneled in the rich, dark wood of the lobby. Across from the bar, on the other side of the room, is a fireplace with a handsome mantle, and above the fireplace is an oil painting, a dark, moody study of a man holding a pheasant by the feet. The windows look out onto the front lawn. In front of the fireplace is a gathering of small tables and aged, comfortable leather chairs. It's a man's room. He wonders whether he should stay and hope a bartender shows up, or return to the lobby and have a drink brought out there. It's awkward traveling alone. He sits in a leather club chair by the fireplace, even though there is as yet no fire burning in the grate, waits a few minutes, supposes that no one is coming, and wanders back out to the lobby. There's no one there either. The young man who was behind the desk earlier has vanished. David taps the old-fashioned bell on the front desk. The clear ring is louder than he expected, and he starts a little. The same young man from before rushes up to the desk, appearing from the hall that runs behind it, beside the staircase. "So sorry to keep you waiting," he says. "We're a bit short-staffed because of the weather." He smiles apologetically. "I was wondering if I could get a drink." "Of course. We're going to be serving drinks here in the lobby. I'll be bringing out the bar cart in a couple of minutes." "That's fine," David says amicably. He just wants a drink, a comfortable chair, and a warm fire. And then a good dinner and a deep, undisturbed sleep. He sits down and wonders who might join him. He soon hears the rumble of wheels and the sound of glasses and glances up and sees the young man pushing a well-stocked bar cart into the lobby. The usual bar staples are there, as well as a cocktail shaker, a bucket of ice, several mixes and garnishes, good liqueurs and assorted glasses. Underneath are wine bottles, as well as a champagne bucket filled with ice, with the foil-wrapped neck of a bottle sticking out. "What will you have?" asks the young man. He's just a kid, really, David thinks. He looks so young, 21 maybe. "What's your name?" David asks. "Bradley," he answers. "Are you old enough to serve alcohol in the state of New York, Bradley?" he quips. "I'm older than I look," Bradley grins. 22. "Then a gin and tonic, please," David says, smiling back. He prepares the drink expertly. As David watches him, he catches movement in the corner of his eye and looks up. There's a youngish couple coming down the stairs. "Oh, look," the man says, spying at the cart. He smiles and rubs his hands together for effect. David can't help but notice his smile. It makes the man instantly likable. He's tall and lanky, with rumpled brown hair and a 5 o'clock shadow, the casual type in jeans and a plaid shirt. But David suspects he could carry that look off anywhere. David is pleased to see him. He could use some light, distracting conversation. The woman with him is attractive, but not as striking as the woman who passed him a while ago on the stairs. For a moment, he wonders if everyone here is part of a couple.
"Mind if we join you?" the man says.
"Not at all," David says.
"I'm Ian,"
he says and extends a hand. The woman beside him reaches out her hand in turn and says, "I'm Lauren."
"Pleased to meet you," he says. "David."
It seems a bit empty, Lauren muses, looking around. Bradley nods and says,
"The hotel isn't full. We have 12 guest rooms, but only 6 are occupied this weekend. We had some cancellations because of the snow,
and some of our staff, the bartender for one and the housekeeper for another, weren't able to make it in. But I'm here, so we're good.
He clasps his hands together.
I know a few things about mixing drinks,
he adds spontaneously.
The bartender's been teaching me. Excellent,
Ian says.
Can you make me a whiskey and soda?
Of course. And I'll have a Manhattan, Lauren says.
Did the chef make it in okay?
Ian asks.
Because I'm starving.
Bradley cocks one eyebrow.
Don't worry, my dad's the chef. It's a family-owned hotel. We live on site, in an apartment at the end of the hall, past the bar.
He nods toward the hallway.
He and I should be able to manage all right until the roads are cleared, although dinner will be more of a buffet tonight.
A blast of wind slams angrily against the windows. The guests turn instinctively toward the sound.
We get some good storms up here,
Bradley says. Now David notices an older man appear in the lobby. Judging by the apron he's wearing, he came from the kitchen, which must be behind the dining room. Bradley's father.
Welcome, he says. I'm James Harwood, the owner of the hotel, and the chef, he adds. And don't worry, I promise we will take very good care of you, whatever the weather.
David sizes him up. He has a confident air, someone who is certain he can make good on his promise. He's obviously been very successful with this hotel. He's proud of his establishment, and it shows. He chats with them for a moment and returns to his kitchen. David settles back in his chair, once again looking forward to his weekend. Lauren watches Ian charm the man sitting by the fire. Ian can get on with anyone. He's already discovered that David is a criminal defense attorney from New York City. Now he's trying to draw him out about some of his cases.
What was the most interesting case you ever worked on?
Ian asks curiously.
They're all interesting,
the attorney says, with a slightly evasive smile. Are there any we might have read about in the papers? Lauren asks.
Possibly.
At that moment, she senses someone coming down the staircase and glances upward over her shoulder. She sees that it's Gwen and Riley. She catches the attorney watching them as they descend. The two women make their way over to them and sit down together on a sofa across from the fire. Gwen gives them a tentative smile. Riley doesn't look at anyone. But Bradley is there with the drinks, creating a useful distraction. They each ask for a glass of Merlot and fall silent. Gwen looks quite different without her ski hat and puffy winter jacket, Lauren thinks. She's petite and slim, and her shiny black hair makes a striking contrast to her creamy white skin. Riley is taller, and her blonde hair falls limply to her shoulders. She looks unhealthy next to Gwen. Ian won't let it go with David, the attorney.
Have you defended any murderers?
He asks. His enthusiasm finally brings a reluctant smile to the attorney's face.
Yes, I have.
He swirls his drink around in his glass.
Many. Come on, tell us.
Never mind him, Lauren interjects. I think he watches too many crime shows.
It's not always like it is on TV,
the attorney says. What do you mean? Lauren asks, noting his downturned mouth.
He shrugs. On TV, justice is usually served. It doesn't always work out that way in real life. You mean, as a defense attorney, you're too good at your job?
Ian suggests, and they all laugh. Lauren can hear the two women murmuring now, but she can't quite hear what they are saying. They're keeping their voices low.
I do my best, the attorney says.
How do you do it? Lauren asks him. How do you reconcile what you do with your conscience, defending someone you know might be guilty of something horrible? Then she adds hastily, I'm sorry, I don't mean to judge. David Paley looks down at his almost empty glass and thinks about how to answer. It's a question he's been asked many times. He's been very successful as a defense attorney. As a human being, he's not so sure.
His partners at the firm have gently suggested that he take some time off, perhaps travel. But he has no one to travel with. He no longer has a wife. And while traveling the world might distract him for a while, it won't mend the emptiness in his soul. Spending the better part of his career successfully defending murderers has definitely taken its toll. But he has his answer to Lauren's question down. He knows what to say. He doesn't necessarily have to believe it. I have a job to do as a defense attorney. Under our legal system, everyone is presumed innocent until proven guilty. My job is to represent any accused to the best of my ability, he adds. If attorneys could simply refuse to represent someone because of their own squeamishness or conscience. She is listening to him intently. He shrugs. Well, without the defense attorney, the system wouldn't work. He takes a large swallow of his drink. It all sounds so good. You have to look at the bigger picture, he adds. He doesn't tell them how difficult that can be. He realizes now that the two women sitting a bit farther away on the sofa are both watching him, listening. He finds the dark-haired one quietly attractive. She looks at him with intelligent, appraising eyes. He would like to talk to her. Perhaps the weekend will turn out to be distracting after all. Gwen looks at the attorney sitting by the fire. He's older than she is, perhaps 40 or so. His short dark hair is beginning to gray at the temples. He has a good face, attractive and kind, and a sort of rueful smile that appeals to her. She likes the sound of his voice, its timbre. It carries without effort, probably from years of speaking in court. He has a confidence and ease about himself that she finds attractive. She's a modern young woman. She considers herself a feminist, but she has never been particularly sure of herself. It's a quality that she admires, even envies in others. She wants to be strong and independent, like Riley. Well, like Riley used to be. She glances at her friend. But just look where that got her. Beside her, Riley guzzles her first glass of wine like water on a hot day, or as if she were drinking shots with the boys. She was always an accomplished drinker. Gwen's own drink is barely touched, and now she takes a big gulp. Riley seems to emerge from her semi-catatonic state to motion to the young man with the bar cart and says, "May I have another?" "Of course," he says, and pours her another glass. "Thank you," Riley says, and chugs it right back. Now everyone is silent, watching her, and Gwen is uneasy and embarrassed. She doesn't want Riley to draw attention to herself. She also doesn't want her to get drunk. She has no idea what she will do, what she will be like. Riley always used to be a fun drunk, a party girl. But now, Gwen doesn't know what to expect. She's so different since she came back from Afghanistan this time. Sometimes she's withdrawn and just stares at nothing. Other times she's irritable and even a bit aggressive. And her occasional displays of nervous energy, her fidgeting, the way her eyes dart around constantly, it's already beginning to get on Gwen's nerves. Inadvertently, she catches the attorney's eye and quickly looks away. She's already regretting suggesting this weekend away. Her car is sitting in a ditch miles from here. The tow company said they wouldn't be able to fetch it until the morning. By then, it will probably be so buried that they won't be able to find it. She leans in closer to Riley and whispers, "Maybe you should slow down." Chapter 4. Dana slips out from under the covers, slapping Matthew's hand away as he reaches for her. She smiles at him. "We should go down. Aren't you hungry?" "Now that you mention it," he says cheerfully, and gets out of the bed. She gets dressed quickly in a simple but elegantly cut dress. Everything she wears flatters her. Genetics has been kind to her, and she now has the money to make the most of what she's been given. Matthew is a warm, generous man, and she's very much in love with him. Of course, the money doesn't hurt. She thinks often of how lucky she is, of how awful it must be for most women to marry and have children on a budget. She's well aware that she and Matthew have a charmed life. She's not going to apologize for it, but she's certainly not going to rub anyone's nose in it either. She knows what it's like to want desperately, things that you can't have. To anyone who doesn't know who Matthew is, they just come across as a well-heeled, successful couple. But Matthew is from money, and lots of it. "Ready?" he asks, as she puts in her second earring. She's sitting at the antique dressing table, looking at him in the mirror as he stands behind her. It feels very romantic. "Why don't ladies have dressing tables like this anymore?" she asks.
"I don't know. They should," he says,
looking back at her in the mirror and gently touching a tendril of her long hair. "After dinner, we can sit in front of the fire here and drink the champagne they've left us," she says. She thinks about how lovely it will be, just the two of them, here, in this perfect room, by the light of the fire, the snow still coming down, silencing the outside world. How far away from their everyday lives it feels. Matthew closes their door behind them and shoves the key into his pocket. When they come around the landing and view the lobby, he sees a small gathering of fellow guests. The young man who was at the front desk earlier is mixing drinks, chatting comfortably with the handful of people seated near the fireplace.
"Bar's closed this evening," the young man says as they reach the bottom of the stairs and approach the group. "We're missing a bartender and making do. I hope that's all right," he says.
"No problem at all," Matthew assures him, smiling, his hand on the small of Dana's back. It looks like a cozy enough arrangement. They sit down on a sofa across from a couple close to their age. There's a slightly older man who seems to be on his own, and a pair of women sharing a sofa across from the fire.
"What will you have?"
the young man asks, smiling appreciatively at Dana.
"A vodka martini, please," she says.
"Make mine a scotch on the rocks."
"Thanks," Matthew says.
"I'm Bradley,"
the young man says.
"I'm David," says the man by himself. "He's a criminal attorney,"
the man across from him says.
"I'm Ian, and this is Lauren."
Lauren smiles at him.
"I'm Matthew, and this is my fiancée, Dana," he says.
Ian leans over and indicates the women on the sofa.
"And these are Gwen and Riley."
Gwen nods and smiles demurely. Riley looks at them and gives the briefest of smiles before turning away to stare into the fire.
"We found them in a ditch not far from here,"
he adds, smiling. He seems friendly, Matthew thinks. Easy to talk to. Easy to like. Gwen offers, "We're lucky they came along, or we'd probably still be out there, frozen to death by now." The wind rattles the windows, as if to underline what she's said. "I'll have to have a tow truck get my car out in the morning. They couldn't come tonight, obviously. The roads are too bad."
"We're lucky we got here when we did," Matthew says, "or we might not have made it at all. I think the storm's worse than they expected." "I know," Bradley says. "Sometimes I wonder about the weather forecasters. My father says it's more useful to look out the window. He's got the radio on in the kitchen. The main highway has been closed, and they say the side roads are pretty much impassable. Some of our guests couldn't make it here, but frankly, that's a good thing. We're short-handed because of the storm."
"Oh, dear," Gwen says.
"Don't worry, we can look after you all right,"
Bradley says, with a brash confidence. He's a good-looking young man, Matthew thinks, and very sure of himself, almost cocky. "I hope the power doesn't go off," Lauren says.
"If it does," Bradley assures them, "most of the rooms have fireplaces, and the woodshed is well stocked with wood and kindling. And we have some oil lanterns if we need them." "That actually sounds kind of nice," Ian says.
Matthew catches movement out of the corner of his eye and looks up. Another couple is coming down the staircase. They're older than he and Dana, maybe in their late 40s. The man looks put out about something, and the woman beside him looks as if she's trying to make the best of it. The man joins them and immediately says to Bradley, "I could use a scotch and soda." He takes the drink from Bradley when it's offered and stands by the fireplace, leaving his wife alone by the bar cart. Bradley asks her, "What can I get you, ma'am?"
"I'll have a gin and tonic, please," she says politely.
"Come sit," Gwen says, moving over a little and patting the empty spot on the sofa beside her. The woman looks at her gratefully and joins her, sinking down into the cushions. Ian makes the introductions and then looks pointedly at the man standing in front of the fireplace.
"I'm Henry," he says, "and that's my wife, Beverly."
"Pleased to meet you," Beverly murmurs to everyone.
"We were just talking about the storm," Lauren says.
"Bradley was telling us that we are completely snowed in and reassuring us that we have nothing to worry about if the power goes out."
"There's no cell reception up here,"
Henry complains,
"and no Wi-Fi. It's like being buried alive."
There's a startled silence at this.
"We've never had cell reception,"
Bradley says, flushing slightly at the rebuke.
"Or Wi-Fi. It's in our brochure. Many of our guests come up here to get away from all that."
Matthew notices the sour look Henry shoots at his wife, as if it's her fault there's no Wi-Fi. Maybe that's what he's so annoyed about.
"The scenery is lovely, though," Beverly says gamely, "and I see there are lots of books here."
It's true. Matthew has noticed bookcases around the hotel, filled with books of all sorts. "I found an old Agatha Christie on my bedside table," Lauren volunteers.
"That's me,"
Bradley says.
"I put books in all the rooms. So much nicer than chocolates on the pillows, don't you think? Although we do the chocolates too, of course."
He grins. "I think it's refreshing," Lauren says.
"We actually have a rather extensive library. I can find you something else if you like. I'm very familiar with what's in there. I've read most of them. Our guests like to read in the library, of course, but in the summer, they read in the hammock, or by the pool, or in the gazebo."
"We'll have to come back up here in the summer," Matthew says, smiling at Dana, "after we're married."
"You should," Bradley agrees. "It's lovely here in the summer. But it's just as lovely in the winter. I can light a fire in the library after dinner if anyone wants to sit in there."
"We'd like to see the ice house," Lauren says. "What is the ice house exactly?"
Beverly asks.
Bradley smiles.
"It's a little outbuilding made entirely from ice and snow. We had it made into a bar. Everything is carved from ice. The bar, the shelves, the stools even. And there's some wicked sculpture. The only thing in there that isn't made out of ice is the bottles and the glasses and the bar tools. It's pretty amazing. I haven't had a chance to clear the path out to it yet, but I'll get this snowblower out and it will be open tomorrow. I promise."
"It sounds cold," Gwen says.
"You'll need a jacket,"
Bradley admits.
The atmosphere in the room has shifted slightly since the arrival of Dana and Matthew. Lauren couldn't help noticing how the men in the room reacted when Dana joined them, Bradley gawking at her as he served her drink. The older men are better able to hide their feelings. Nonetheless, it's impossible to ignore that Dana's remarkable beauty has affected everyone. It's as if they are all suddenly sitting up straighter. Even Ian. She gives him a little kick now, irritated, and he returns his attention to her. Lauren knows that she herself is an attractive woman, and she has no doubts about Ian finding her so. But Dana is in another class altogether. It's not just her beauty, which is hard to ignore. It's her glamour, her awareness of her own gorgeousness. She makes every other woman in the room feel second rate without even trying. There's something about exceptionally beautiful women, Lauren has noticed, that makes them think they're entitled to anything they want. Lauren finds herself staring at Dana. Suddenly, as if she can feel Lauren's eyes on her, Dana looks directly at her. The smile on her lovely face doesn't falter as her gaze lingers on Lauren. Dana reminds Lauren of someone. She can't think who. Maybe she just reminds her of all those women who look out from movie screens and magazines, the ones who remind the rest of them of their own shortcomings. Lauren turns away first. She catches Gwen and Riley watching Dana, too. Friday, 6:45 p.m. When James emerges from his kitchen and enters the lobby to check on the guests, he sees the cocktail hour is in full swing. The guests are chatting with each other, and everything seems quite convivial. They've been drinking for a while already, and there's something about being snowed in that has a way of bringing people together. His son glances up at him as he enters the lobby. Bradley is holding an uncorked bottle of champagne, Veuve Clicquot, loosely by the neck. He's a rather striking young man, and now a lock of hair is falling forward on his forehead, which lends him a certain rakish charm. He's tall and lean and athletic, and looks perfectly at ease in his slim black trousers and crisp white shirt. He wears clothes well, and Bradley is so good with the guests, so confident and outgoing, like his mother had been. James is more at ease behind the scenes, in his kitchen, wearing his apron, or looking over his accounts. Still, he has his concerns about Bradley. He worries about him stepping over the line. He's still young and impulsive. He has to remember that he's a server, not a guest. There are boundaries to be observed. Bradley hasn't always been so good at observing boundaries. All of the women are now drinking champagne out of old-fashioned coupe glasses. Occasionally, a fussy guest will request a flute, but most enjoy the decadent 20s feel of the coupes. James loves them himself. They go so nicely with his hotel. Bradley makes the introductions. Now James can put names to the faces. "We've switched to champagne," Lauren says, raising her glass.
"Excellent choice," James agrees.
"Since we're snowed in here, we've decided we're going to make the most of it," announces Dana, a strikingly pretty young woman with a large diamond engagement ring on her finger.
"The ladies are celebrating," Henry says, standing in front of the fireplace and holding a drink aloft, "but the men are just drinking."
"Have we met everyone now, Bradley?" Ian asks. "You don't have any other guests staying tonight in the hotel?"
"No, there's one more," Bradley says. "A woman arrived this morning. I don't think we'll see much of her. She says she's writing a book and wants quiet."
"A book?" Dana says. "What kind of a book?"
"I have no idea. She didn't say."
"What's her name?" asks Gwen.
"Candace White," Bradley says. "Do you know it?"
Everyone in the room shakes their head.
"Anyway, that's it," Bradley says. "And no more coming, not in this weather."
Chapter 5. Candace White sits at the antique writing desk in front of the window in her room and looks out at the wintry landscape, grateful that she arrived early, before the snow. She's been able to put in a good day of work. She'd driven up from New York City early in the morning, desperate to escape. She's a bundle of resentment and raw nerves these days. It's not that she has a family of her own that needs her, a rumpled husband and adoring small children with sticky hands. She revises. If she'd had children, they'd probably be teenagers by now, and perhaps not so adoring. She does this sometimes, imagines what her children would have been like at different ages, in different circumstances, if she'd had them, if she'd been lucky in love. But no, she has not been lucky in love. Not for her, the happy ending. Instead, as the only unmarried one of three daughters
and the only one who's gay, she's been stuck with the lion's share of caring for their widowed and declining mother because her rather selfish sisters are too busy with their own demanding families who adore them. Candace feels that she has been doubly cheated, denied the happiness that her sisters seem to take for granted, and saddled with the thankless,